Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Feline Medicine, Martha Cannon. Thank you, Martha. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Emma, and thank you, everybody, for logging in to this webinar today. As you can see, we're going to look at the subject of hypothyroidism in cats, and that's a disease which we will all be very familiar with. It's clearly quite a common problem in older cats and something which I guess we all hopefully feel reasonably familiar with. But it is an interesting disease, and there are some new developments in treatment options for hypothyroidism and new developments in our understanding of some of the complexities of the disease in terms of diagnostics as well as treatment. And those are the things that I really want to focus on today. So I'm not going to make any attempt to be to cover all aspects of hypothyroidism. I'm going to try and zone in on those more problematic areas and particularly on some of the newer thinking on the diagnosis and management of hypothyroidism. So I hope everyone can see the slides clearly. Do type in any questions as you go along if you have any, and I'll try and address those towards the end of the presentation. And hopefully, if you have any technical problems, Emma's on hand to help you out with those. So let's start with a case. This is a little cat called Tom. You can see he's a 16-year-old male neutered domestic short hair. And Tom is normally a very good eater and been a pretty healthy sort of cat for all that he's getting on in life. But his owners have recently been aware that his appetite has not been as good as it might be. Some days good, some days less good. So he's not off his food entirely, but they're just a bit concerned about him. You can see from the picture that he's also a little bit underweight now. He's lost a fairly significant amount of weight, actually. He's gone from 3.7 kilograms to 3.4, so probably around an 8% body loss. His coat is a bit poor, but otherwise on physical examination, nothing much else for us to identify or be concerned about. If we run a blood panel on a cat like Tom, this might be a fairly familiar sort of panel of tests to run, and you can see the results that we got for Tom. And I've highlighted in a kind of pinkish-purple colour the ones that are outside the laboratory reference ranges for you. So take a look at that for a moment, see what you would interpret from that. You can see that he's got mildly elevated urea and creatinine. Mildly elevated ALT, he's got a subnormal potassium level, and he's got low lymphocytes, which of course is very common in unwell cats, so nothing I think too much to be alarmed about on the full blood count side of the slide. And then the other thing that I would highlight here is that his urine-specific gravity is really very low. So for a cat, for urine-specific gravity to be below 1035, starts to be concerning, and anything below 1030 we would certainly consider to be polyuric. So I think looking at this panel, I would hope we could all agree that Tom unfortunately has evidence of chronic kidney disease in that he's got inappropriately dilute urine with elevated urea and creatinine. That's probably perhaps also the explanation for the low potassium, and that just leaves us with the slightly elevated ALT. So Tom has chronic kidney disease. We would look at the IRIS staging system and say that he's in stage 2 chronic kidney disease. But the other question we need to ask ourselves is, what about his thyroid status? With a total T4 of 46.8, so well within the reference range, we have to ask ourselves the question, is Tom hypothyroid? Or is he appearing in a hypothyroid webinar as a bit of a red herring? And the problem here, of course, is that we do use total T4 as our main means of diagnosing hypothyroidism. But we do recognize that although it is an extremely useful screening tool, and it is rare for it to identify hypothyroidism in a cat that is not hypothyroid, we do have some problems at the other end of the scale, because there are a significant proportion of cats who are hypothyroid but have normal total T4. And it's difficult to put a number on that. Estimates vary. It depends on the circumstances. But we can probably say that around about 10% of hyperthyroid cats will have a total T4 that falls within the reference range, which doesn't mean that it isn't a useful and appropriate first-line test. It certainly is, and it certainly should remain our first-line test. But we need to be aware there will be some times when we need to look a bit further. So how does this arise, and why would a cat who is indeed hyperthyroid have a normal total T4? And the first thing to bear in mind is that, like all endocrine systems, the level of total T4 in the blood is not consistent from hour to hour and day to day. And you can see from this very old publication, 1987, so we've known about this for a very long time, you can see that there is quite significant day-to-day variation in the level of total T4. So look at the white circles. Now, the units are American units, so don't be confused by those, but you can see that the grey zone is the normal range. And if we look at those white circles, we can see that on days 1, 2, and 3, the cat would be considered hyperthyroid. But on days 4 through to 8, if you were measuring on those days, you would say he was not hyperthyroid based on total T4. Then it swings up again before swinging down again. So you can see that there's a kind of cyclical variation in total T4. And in the early stages of hyperthyroidism, we may well find that at the low points of the cycle, the total T4 falls within the reference range, whereas at the high points in the cycle, it is outside the range. So just that day-to-day variation and the natural cycles do mean that in the early stages of hyperthyroidism, total T4 can fall within the reference range on a significant number of days. Another thing we need to bear in mind is that the reference range for any laboratory parameter is calculated by looking at the level of the analytes, so in this case total T4, in a wide range of healthy cats and plotting the various results we get. And we would expect to get a roughly bell-shaped curve, so a normal distribution of results. And the reference range is calculated to include around 90% of cases. But what that does mean is that some cats will have actually a total T4 that is below or above the reference range, even though they are completely healthy, because they are the outliers. And equally, unless we know for the cat that we are looking at what is normal for that individual cat, we may have a situation where in health and youth, the cat was one of the ones whose normal T4 fell at the low end of the range, such that if his total T4 is now at the high end of the range, even though it's within range, that could reflect a very significant increase in total T4 for that individual cat. So it's the usual problem. We are applying a population reference range to an individual animal, and it would be much more helpful if we knew what that cat's normal T4 was in youth and health to be able to compare the current result with that, rather than the whole population. And then the third area, and this is certainly an area that we run into on a relatively frequent basis, third area of concern is that we know that when there is concurrent disease outside of the thyroid gland, it will suppress the total T4 level. And this is a concept that has been termed sick euthyroid syndrome. Because a cat who is hyperthyroid but has concurrent disease, that suppression of total T4 may bring it into what appears to be a normal thyroid range. Now, this is very well documented for cats with chronic kidney disease, but we also know that it can occur with other chronic concurrent diseases. We might be suspicious if there was inflammatory bowel disease or concurrent liver disease, diabetes, any of these chronic metabolic disorders that are so common in older cats. And so if we see a normal total T4 in a cat that we either know or suspect to have other concurrent disease, we need to be particularly careful in interpreting the result. Just want to illustrate that a little bit more, and particularly, as I say, cats with chronic kidney disease and hyperthyroidism, which is, of course, a very common comorbidity, we do have quite a lot of data now to support this concept. So this is a study that came out of the Royal Veterinary College quite a few years ago now, and they looked at cats that were that had chronic kidney disease. So all the cats in the study had chronic kidney disease, but some of them were hyperthyroid and some of them were not hyperthyroid. And they looked at their thyroid test results in those two categories. If we look at the cats who had both chronic kidney disease and hyperthyroidism, we find that they did indeed all have total T4 within the reference range, which for the laboratory test that they were using, the top of the reference range was 55. So all of these cats were hyperthyroid but had chronic kidney disease, and they were all exhibiting this sick euthyroid syndrome where their total T4 is suppressed to within the reference range. However, looking in a little more detail, it's interesting to see that of the 20 cats that had chronic kidney disease but were not hyperthyroid, they also had suppression of their total T4. And what that meant was that all of those cats had a total T4 that was less than 30 nanomoles per litre. Whereas when we look at the cats with hyperthyroidism and chronic kidney disease, they did have their T4 suppressed within the reference range, but not to the same degree as the non-hyperthyroid cats. So the majority of them, 14 out of 16, the total T4 was above 30, so still in the top half of the reference range, whereas all the cats that were not hyperthyroid had a T4 below 30. So we can still use total T4 in these cases, but we need to be cautious about the interpretation. If we need extra support to our diagnosis, and when we find total T4 in the normal range but are still suspicious of hyperthyroidism, I think we do need more data. This is where the additional free T4 test can be very useful. It's high in around 95% of hyperthyroid cases, so it will pick up a proportion of the cats whose total T4 is normal. The problem with it, and the reason why we don't use it as a first diagnostic screening test, is that it will also be high in around 20% of cats who are not hyperthyroid but have other non-thyroidal illness. So if we relied on free T4 only, we would pick up most hyperthyroid cats, but we would also diagnose one in five cats that were not hyperthyroid but were ill for other reasons. So it would not be useful as a screening test. But if we combine a total T4 test and a free T4 test in the same sample, so taken at the same moment, then we get quite a useful pairing, because those cats who are hyperthyroid and also have concurrent disease will tend to have quite low total T4, whereas those cats that have high that are ill for other reasons will tend to have high free T4. So things work in opposite directions. So that's illustrated again in the study we've been looking at. The cats with both chronic kidney disease and hyperthyroidism, 15 of the 16 of them had elevated free T4, as we would expect. So the fact that they had chronic kidney disease didn't affect the free T4. On the other side of the coin, those cats that were not hyperthyroid but had chronic kidney disease, a proportion of them, 4 out of the 20, had high free T4. So again, this illustrates that we don't use this as a primary standalone test because we would get too many false positives. But if we combine it with a total T4 and interpret the two tests together, it becomes a much more powerful tool. So normal free T4 makes it very unlikely that the cat is hyperthyroid. If the free T4 comes out high, that's when we need to use total T4 as to color our interpretation. And high free T4 with a total T4 that is in the higher end of the reference range, so above 30, makes it very likely that the cat has hyperthyroidism. Whereas high free T4 in a cat with suppressed total T4 to the bottom half of the reference range makes it very likely that the cat has non-thyroidal illness. Again, this is not definitive. We can't say for absolutely certain, but the combination of free T4 and total T4 with clinical signs and physical examination, will often give you the certainty that you need to make your diagnosis. If you're still in doubt, if those two together are still leaving room for doubt and you need something further to give you extra information, then it may be useful to run a TSH assay. Now, we don't have a feline-specific TSH assay yet. It will be very useful when it comes. But the canine TSH test, of course, is widely available. It's not completely accurate and useful in cats because it's not really sensitive enough. And again, there's a lot of overlap between the results in healthy and hyperthyroid cats, so we wouldn't use it as a standalone test. But in addition to total T4 and to free T4, if we add in a canine TSH, then again, it can just help to firm up our confidence in diagnostics. So again, looking at those cats who had mild chronic kidney disease, and some were hyperthyroid and some were not, in a hyperthyroid cat, we would predict that TSH levels would be very low because there is no need for thyroid stimulating hormone in a hyperthyroid environment. So as exactly as we would expect, the 16 cats that were hyperthyroid, in all cases, the canine TSH level was below the sensitivity of the assay, so they had undetectable levels of canine TSH. Whereas in the 20 cats that had chronic kidney disease but were not hyperthyroid, the majority of them, 18 out of 20, had canine TSH at a detectable level. So undetectable canine TSH suggests hyperthyroidism. Detectable amounts of TSH suggest that the cat is not hyperthyroid. So there's a number of additional tests we can run when we're faced with a cat like Tom. And just to recap, here is his blood panel. So we can see that he does certainly have chronic kidney disease. But the total T4 is higher than we would expect in a cat with chronic kidney disease. So most cats with chronic kidney disease will have a total T4 below 30. Tom has a total T4 of 46.8. I think it would be a little ahead of the game to just make the diagnosis based on that alone. But if we run those additional tests and we find that his free T4 is elevated and his canine TSH level is undetectable, then that combination can allow us to make a diagnosis of hyperthyroidism with a degree of certainty. So high free T4 with total T4 greater than 30, he's very likely to be hyperthyroid. Undetectable canine TSH means he's very likely to be hyperthyroid, and the combination of the tests together allow us to reach that diagnosis. And of course, that combination of chronic kidney disease and hyperthyroidism is very common. These are two diseases that are common in older cats, but we also recognize that there is quite a strong interplay between the two diseases, and in particular, we recognize that being hyperthyroid can actually be damaging to the kidneys. So there is a mechanism by which the two diseases would commonly occur together. But it's confounded by the fact that hyperthyroid cats are partially protected from the effects or the signs of chronic kidney disease. Because in the hyperthyroid state, there is increased cardiac output and therefore increased perfusion of the kidneys. And that increased perfusion of the kidneys is, in a way, artificially pushing up the glomerular filtration rate and therefore maintaining a better level of kidney function than would be there if the hyperthyroidism wasn't there. So these cats, when they are both hyperthyroid and have chronic kidney disease, their kidneys are working overtime and being pushed to their limit, and so their azotemia is less severe and their kidney function appears better than it really is. So again, we need to be careful if we know a cat is hyperthyroid, we need to be cautious when interpreting the kidney disease tests. However, although the cat's kidney function will look better on the blood panel, and although the kidneys are functioning At a better level, we know that the hypothyroidism contributes to the progression of the chronic kidney disease. So it's a temporarily improved looking situation, which will ultimately become a worse situation. And this is because, again, of that hyperfiltration that's going on. The changes in blood pressure in the systemic circulation in the hypothyroid cat are transmitted through to the glomerular vessels. Normally, the glomerular vessels are protected from variation in systemic blood pressure, but that protection is lost in hypothyroidism. And so peaks in systolic blood pressure cause hypertension within the glomerulus, and that hypertension is damaging and ultimately will lead to glomerular sclerosis and loss of that nephron function. So being hypothyroid will tend to contribute to the progression of chronic kidney disease. And of course, the chronic kidney disease is irreversible. And so we do recommend treatment of hypothyroidism in all cases, even when there is concurrent chronic kidney disease, accepting that in treating it, we will make the kidney disease look worse than it looked before we started, but we're only uncovering the level of disease that is there. We're not actually causing kidney damage. And it's important that we explain that to owners before we start so they're aware of the situation, but it's certainly not a reason not to treat the hypothyroidism. Saying that, we probably would want to start initially at least with either medical or nutritional management of the hypothyroidism in order to get gradual control over the level of thyroid hormone rather than to drop the levels too quickly, which could come as quite a shock to the kidneys. And while we do want to maintain the total T4 in the lower half of the reference range when we're managing hypothyroidism, we do also need to avoid hypothyroidism, particularly in this cohort of cats with concurrent kidney disease. And I'll illustrate that a bit more, and we'll talk a bit more about iatrogenic hypothyroidism shortly. But important when we know there is chronic kidney disease to bring the T4 down gradually, and to keep an eye on both the total T4, but also the kidney function, so the levels of urea and creatinine. And then, obviously, if we are using medical treatment and we've started quite cautiously, we can gradually increase the dose as required to hopefully gently bring the thyroid level under control and into that lower half of the reference range. Now, when we do that, when we control the hypothyroidism, as I've said, we do expect a drop in glomerular filtration rate, and therefore we do expect a small increase in the degree of azotemia. But it is usually only a small increase, and the important thing to be aware of is that those changes will occur within the first 4 weeks of stabilization of the thyroid situation. But after that, the glomerular filtration rate should not be further affected. Renal function should not be further affected. So you should see that increase in azotemia within the first 4 weeks, but then you should establish a new normal, if you like, and azotemia should then be static. So if you see a continually increasing level of azotemia over the months and years, that is the kidney disease itself deteriorating. It's not a persistent and ongoing effect of the treatment that you're giving. So you should be concerned about it. It does indicate ongoing progression of kidney disease. So we expect when we treat hypothyroidism to get an early increase in azotemia, but again, it's usually mild and it should be stable. It should allow us to manage the chronic kidney disease in the way that we normally would and to continue to treat the hypothyroidism as normal. And so having established that the new level, if you like, of chronic kidney disease, if the cat is still well and stable, there's no reason not to move to a more definitive form of treatment for the hypothyroidism, whether that's radioactive iodine treatment or whether it's surgery. Those are perfectly reasonable options once we have established what the new level of azotemia is and that azotemia is stable. Now, saying that, in a small proportion of cases, that increase in azotemia may become quite clinically significant if the cat really has got very advanced kidney disease and the tiny increase in in renal perfusion caused by the hypothyroidism was the only thing that was keeping the cat the right side of the line, then you might find that the cat does deteriorate quite significantly. Again, it's not a consequence of the medical treatment that you've used. It's not an adverse effect of treatment. It's simply a reflection of how very severe the underlying kidney disease really is. So we are uncovering the severity of the disease. So we would still want to manage the chronic kidney disease as aggressively as we can, which of course might involve using subcutaneous fluids at home, as well as diets and angiotensin receptor blockers and so on. But the question arises, if the azotemia that has been uncovered really is so severe that it is potentially life-threatening, do we continue to treat the hypothyroidism, or do we actually try to use the enhanced glomerular filtration rate to try and protect the cat from the chronic kidney disease, recognizing that if we do that, if we stop or reduce the antithyroid treatment, while it may improve things in the short term, it will hasten further progression of kidney disease. Now, if the only other option is euthanasia because the kidney disease is already so severe, we may take that short-term view. But really, this is an extreme situation. It's a rare situation, and I guess the main message should be that we don't want to run scared of treating hypothyroidism in cats with chronic kidney disease, because for the vast majority of cats, you will be able to find a good balance, and in the long term, treating the hypothyroidism will be beneficial. Okay, let's move on to another scenario and think about another case. So this is a cat called Tabby, a 14-year-old female neutered domestic short hair. And really, to cut to the chase with Tabby, I can tell you that she had classic but relatively mild clinical signs of hypothyroidism. So she had a good appetite, but she had weight loss. She had a slightly rapid heart rate. She was a little bit unsettled in herself, but otherwise acting like a well cat. On physical examination, there is a unilaterally palpable enlarged thyroid gland in the neck, but really no other significant clinical signs other than the clinical findings other than that mild tachycardia. On blood tests, we can see that she has an elevated total T4. She has normal urea and creatinine. Her urine-specific gravity is a little bit low. I think I said earlier to you that 10.35 would be considered the healthy cutoff point. So at 10.32, her urine-specific gravity is a bit borderline. And while that might concern us that she might be in stage 1 or 2 kidney disease, we do need to be aware that thyroxine is a mild diuretic, and so cats with hypothyroidism will tend to have mildly dilute urine. And so we would certainly want to address the thyroid situation and then monitor that urine-specific gravity to see whether it remains low, suggesting that there is subclinical kidney disease, or whether actually it increases, suggesting that her kidneys are indeed as healthy as we hope. She has a raised ALT, which of course is a very common finding in cats with hypothyroidism because of the increased metabolic turnover in the liver, but otherwise serum biochemistry, electrolytes and hematology are all unremarkable. So Tabby is a cat who does appear to be hypothyroid, but she does appear to be otherwise well, with no concurrent diseases, and at the moment the hypothyroidism hopefully has not done too much damage. So again, to cut to the chase, Tabby was started on medical treatment for her hypothyroidism, perfectly reasonable choice. She was on carbimazole at a dose of 1.25 milligrams twice daily, so quite a low dose, but she's only mildly affected. And there was a really good response. Owner was very happy with the changes in her, her clinical signs resolved, and all seemed to be going well. So, of course, we then need to monitor to see what effect our treatment is having, and we would want to review the kidney situation now that we have controlled the hypothyroidism. So you can see that on a follow-up check, her total T4 has actually crept slightly below the reference range at 9. Urea and creatinine remain normal, and indeed urine-specific gravity is looking a little bit better. So I think we're still quite comfortable with Tabby's kidney function. The ALT is almost normal, although not quite. Hopefully that will continue to improve over time, and no new issues have been uncovered. So on the face of it, I think we would say that that's a good result. The owner is happy with the treatment, she's happy with the response to treatment, and we do seem to have controlled hypothyroidism without unbalancing the kidneys. The concern here, though, is that the total T4 is actually a little bit subnormal, and we have to ask ourselves, is that a concern? Have we over-suppressed Tabby's thyroid level? And if we have, do we need to be concerned about that? Or given how well she now seems in herself, can we continue treatment as we are doing? And that's become a topic of some interest and debate. And I think increasingly we are recognizing that we do need to be cautious about iatrogenic hypothyroidism and that it is something we need to be at least on the lookout for. This is another study out of the Royal Vet College, and this time they're looking at the relationship between iatrogenic hypothyroidism and azotemia. So 75 cats that were treated for hypothyroidism were followed through this study. Now, it has to be said the majority of these cats will have been treated with radioactive iodine. And as we'll see later, unfortunately, radioactive iodine is quite prone to causing post-treatment hypothyroidism, perhaps more so than we would see with medical treatment or with certainly with surgery or dietary treatment. So of the 75 cats that were treated and followed through this study, 28 of them did indeed become hypothyroid following treatment, whereas 47 of them, their thyroid level normalized but did not go subnormal. Looking at those two in a little bit more detail, of the 28 cats that became hypothyroid, 16 of the 28, so 57%, became azotemic over the course of the study. And it was quite a long study. I think it was over a year that they followed these cats. Whereas with the cats that did not go hypothyroid, a proportion of them still became azotemic, as you might expect in cats whose hyperthyroidism is being controlled, and anyway, in an older cohort of cats being followed for a period of time. But you can see that the frequency with which they became azotemic was significantly less. Only 14 of the 47 cats that had normal thyroid levels became azotemic during the study. So a rate of azotemia of only 30% compared to nearly 60% in those cats that became hypothyroid. Following those cats for longer, there was unfortunately also a significant effect on survival time. So of those hypothyroid cats that became azotemic, they had a median survival time of only 456 days. Whereas those cats that remained non-azotemic had a survival of over 900 days. So what this study seems to tell us is that if we induce iatrogenic hypothyroidism, there is we double the risk of the cat becoming azotemic, and those cats that do become azotemic have a 50% reduction in their survival time. So as I say, this has brought us made us sit up and take notice of iatrogenic hypothyroidism and made us realize that it is something that we need to be aware of and on the lookout for. So if we go back to our little cat Tabby, who had a total T4 of 9 following treatment with carbimazole twice daily, then I think we have to wonder, first of all, is she actually hypothyroid? We're measuring total T4, not free T4, and free T4 is the active form of the hormone. And also we recognize that if a cat becomes hypothyroid, they will try to compensate for that, and they will stimulate their kidneys to stimulate their thyroid gland to try and produce more thyroid. And in some cases, they will, to some extent, successfully compensate. So we can't really use total T4 alone to identify genuine iatrogenic hypothyroidism. And the recommendation at the moment would be, as well as measuring total T4, if we are concerned about hypothyroidism, we should also measure again the TSH level, recognizing that we need to use canine TSH at the moment, but recognizing that a cat who is hypothyroid will tend to have high TSH, usually in the range of 1 nanogram per mil, where we have a where the cutoff for detection of the of TSH was down at the 0.3 level, so quite a significantly increased amount of TSH. And if we find that high level of TSH, even in a cat with normal total T4, that is now considered an indication of hypothyroidism because the cat is compensating for the hypothyroid state and at the moment successfully compensating, but it is still in the hypothyroid range. So if we find in Tabby's case that she does have an elevated canine TSH level and that we do appear to be inducing iatrogenic hypothyroidism, we have a number of options in what we might do about that. One option would be to say, well, she's very well in herself. She's not azotemic. She seems to be otherwise healthy, and actually we're just going to carry on treating as we are, monitoring that thyroid level, monitoring for azotemia, and at the moment not rock the boat because she's doing so well. And that may still be an appropriate way to go, but as long as we are continuing to keep an eye on the T4, the urea, and the creatinine. Clearly another option would be to cut back slightly on the amount of carbimazole that we are giving her. And we could do that by going to a once daily dose rather than a twice daily. Perhaps not ideal in a drug that only lasts for 12 hours, but it is a licensed indication. It is an option. If we want to maintain 24-hour cover, so we want to maintain twice daily dosing, we would need to cut down the amount per dose. And of course, that's difficult to do with the tablet forms of antithyroid medication. But we do now have a liquid form in the form of Thyronorm, which does seem to be very palatable and well tolerated by cats. And that does give us the opportunity to titrate the dose a little. So an option there would be to switch to the methimazole liquid, establish a low twice daily dose that maintains the thyroid level in a more normal range, but not allowing it up into the top half of the range. Thyroidectomy would be an option. She has a palpable thyroid gland, so thyroidectomy would be an option. And if it's a unilateral thyroidectomy, we shouldn't run into problems with hypothyroidism because the remaining gland can compensate. We have the option to use dietary treatment, which we'll come on and talk about briefly at the end. And again, that has the advantage that it certainly shouldn't cause hypothyroidism. Rather, one of the concerns with dietary management is that sometimes it doesn't seem to control things quite as adequately as we would like. And then, of course, there is the gold standard option of radioactive iodine treatment. But as I've mentioned to you, one of the potential issues with that is that it is even more prone to causing hypothyroidism, and of course we're less able to titrate and control that if it does indeed occur. So the nice thing about treating hypothyroidism is, as you can see from this slide, we have a lot of choices of medications, of dietary treatment, of surgical treatment, of radioactive iodine treatment. So generally there is a treatment option that is going to be appropriate for any one particular case. But which one we choose will depend a lot on the circumstances of the case and the owner and the costs and so on. So really, I think many of those would be appropriate things to do for Tabby. Of all of them, perhaps the one I would be most concerned to perhaps not rush into would be the radioactive iodine until we are happy that she is no longer hypothyroid. So I think we would be looking to adjust her medical treatment or think about thyroidectomy or dietary treatment. But just let's focus on radioactive iodine for a moment, because that all sounds a little bit negative. I think radioactive iodine is an ideal treatment for most cats with hypothyroidism. It is considered, if you like, the gold standard and the treatment of choice, because it is a definitive curative treatment that actually eliminates the adenomatous change rather than just managing the consequences of hypothyroidism. So we know that we can usually effectively treat hypothyroidism in a permanent way by giving a single subcutaneous injection of iodine 131. And it will be well tolerated and very effective, providing good control of hypothyroidism in around 95% of cases. There are a few cats who will remain hyperthyroid post-treatment because it is relatively difficult to establish the exact correct dose for every cat. But 5% treatment failure rate is hopefully not too alarming, and those cases actually will usually respond to a second dose of treatment. So it's not that they're inherently resistant to radioiodine, it's just that it is rather difficult to calculate the correct dose in every case. So it is the treatment of choice if available. It has the advantage that it will find the hypothyroid tissue wherever it is. So if there is ectopic tissue in the thorax or elsewhere, then it will still be an effective treatment. Of course, it has no effect on the parathyroid glands. So whereas if you do a bilateral thyroidectomy, you can run into problems with hypoparathyroidism, that isn't going to be an issue with radioiodine. And as perhaps you'll be aware, increasing numbers of radioiodine centres opening up around the country, and many with really much reduced time of isolation required post-treatment. So in the old days, cats used to have to stay in the isolation unit for 3 and even 4 weeks post-treatment, which of course was a big stumbling block for most owners. Nowadays, a lot of treatment centres are able to release the cats after 1 or 2 weeks, and that does make it much more palatable for the owners and much more affordable for owners because of the reduced hospitalisation time. So it really is a very well-tolerated, very effective treatment which provides a definitive cure of the disease, and I think should be considered particularly in otherwise healthy cats in the who are relatively young and hopefully have many, many years ahead of them. However, as I've already alluded to, post-treatment hypothyroidism is a common dose-dependent adverse effect. And in published studies, the incidence of hypothyroidism following treatment is as high as 25 to 35% of cases. So that is quite a significant number. And important to be aware that they may not be hypothyroidism immediately after treatment. So tests run at the time that they are released from the centre or that you run a month or so later may look very good, but there is still the potential for delayed onset of hypothyroidism, even up to 18 months following treatment. So it is something that we need to monitor for. Again, we don't want to overstate this. Most of these cats will be asymptomatic. Most of them will remain very well with it, and very often it is a temporary situation that self-resolves within the period of about a year or so. So again, we need to be aware of it. We need to look for it, but it shouldn't be a reason not to recommend radioiodine. The cohort of cats that we will worry about, as we saw in that previous study, are those cats who do become hypothyroid and also become azotemic. That is the cohort of cats that we will be concerned about, and those are the cats that we would want to step in and treat. So post-treatment monitoring after radioactive iodine treatment, yes, we need to look at the total T4 to make sure that the cat we're looking at is not in that 5% group that will not respond or will under-respond to treatment and will remain hyperthyroid. Clearly, we need to identify those. But we also want to identify those cats that perhaps are at risk of iatrogenic hypothyroidism. And total T4, as we've seen, may give us a window on that if it drops subnormal. But we are now recognizing population of cats whose total T4 is normal, but they are still hypothyroid because their increased TSH level indicates hypothyroidism that they are currently compensating for. So if we identify post-treatment hypothyroidism and the cat is azotemic or has clinical signs of hypothyroidism, the recommendation would be to treat that cat with L-thyroxine to supplement the thyroid level and bring them out of the hypothyroid state. However, if the cat is asymptomatic and it's not azotemic, the jury is out on whether we need to be concerned about that. And at the moment, the recommendation would be probably not to treat with L-thyroxine, but to certainly keep an eye on them and in particular keep an eye on their urea and creatinine levels and be ready to treat with L-thyroxine if they start to look as if their creatinine is increasing in response to that hypothyroid state. So I hope that makes sense. We need to be aware of the risk of hypothyroidism. We need to be able to diagnose it, and canine TSH would be the recommended test for that now. We don't necessarily need to treat in every case, and it may be a temporary state in many cases, but if we do have hypothyroidism and azotemia, the recommendation would be to supplement with L-thyroxine. Okay, so that was just a few words on radioiodine, which again is considered to be the gold standard for treatment, but is not going to be for every owner and every cat, and in particular, of course, for cats with concurrent diseases that make it unsuitable to have them in a radioiodine treatment centre where they can't be handled and medicated. So diabetic cats, cats with severe chronic kidney disease and so on, you may feel that that radioiodine is not an option, or indeed the radioiodine centres may feel that they don't want to take that case. So medical treatment remains a mainstay, and I think in most practices around the country, the majority of cats who are hyperthyroid will end up on medical treatment either at the beginning of the course of their disease while we stabilise them and prepare them for more definitive treatment, or indeed for those cats that it suits well, they may stay on treatment long term. We have a lot of options now, a number of different tablet forms in both methimazole and carbimazole. I've alluded to the liquid form of methimazole that's now available in the shape of Thyronorm. And of course, we also have the transdermal option. Summit produced transdermal methimazole, little tiny blob rubbed into the skin of the ear twice daily in order to deliver the drug without having to dose tablets or liquids. So a range of treatment options. Generally, we can get good control of hyperthyroidism with these treatments. Many of them are now in an easy to give dosing formula, particularly, as I say, the liquid and the transdermal. So again, this is a treatment option that will suit a lot of cats and a lot of owners. And of course, we have the ability to titrate the dose in order to try and find the happy medium of not under suppressing the thyroid level, but not over suppressing. We do, however, recognize that the antithyroid drugs are a category of drug where adverse effects are relatively common and can be really quite severe. So they are licensed products, they are very appropriate to use, and the majority of their side effects will be transient and mild, and actually you can continue to treat and the cat will accommodate. But you can see that around 14% of cases of cats will suffer some level of mild transient adverse effect. So that's quite high for a licensed drug. So very commonly we see the GI signs of anorexia, vomiting, lethargy following treatment. That's likely to be less of an issue if you're using the transdermal methimazole than if you are dosing orally, but nevertheless it's quite a common thing to find poor appetite and perhaps some vomiting, especially when you first start treatment. Sometimes you'll also pick up mild changes in the red and white cell parameters, but again, in this category the common ones are mild and not of clinical significance. But on the right-hand side of the slide that you're looking at, I've listed some of the, again, relatively common but really quite severe adverse effects. And of these, the one we probably run into most is the onset of a really nasty pruritus causing self-excoriation. The pruritus breaks out around the head and face. You can see a picture there of a cat with a kind of ulcerative dermatitis, and that is a cat that developed that condition as a consequence of antithyroid medication. In some cases, we will see quite severe bone marrow suppression. That can be thrombocytopenia, which, if not detected, can cause significant bleeding problems. Some cats will develop a non-regenerative anemia, which, again, can become very severe if it's not identified and treatment is not stopped. Some cats will get very severe neutropenia. So in monitoring cats post-treatment, we do need to include a full blood count in the monitoring. And if we identify a significant downward trend in platelets or white cells or red cells, then we will need to stop treatment, allow things to recover, and consider other treatment options. The good news is that these severe adverse effects are resolvable. They do settle down if you can get the cat off the antithyroid medication. but they can be life-threatening. The hepatic failure can be very severe. The anemia can be very severe. Thrombocytopenia, not usually an issue unless the cat then needs surgery or a dental extraction or something of that sort. But if that is the case, it can cause very significant problems. So we need to be aware of the potential adverse effects as well as the potential benefits of treatment, and we need to be monitoring for those. Increasingly, though, another concern that has arisen about the long-term use of medical treatment is that what we are doing, of course, is treating the signs of the disease and not the disease itself. So we are inhibiting thyroid production from the hypothyroid tissue, but we are not actually addressing the adenomatous change that is in the gland. That adenomatous change will persist and progress, so the thyroid glands will tend to get larger over time. And as that happens, we may need to gradually increase the dose of medical treatment that is required to maintain effect. So you may find that the cat appears to be getting resistant to the antithyroid treatment. That's not actually what's happening, it's just that the adenomatous change persists and progresses. So that can be an issue, particularly in cats that are on treatment for a long time. A further concern that has been raised is the potential that these drugs may in themselves have a carcinogenic effect on the thyroid gland. And this has sprung from some work from Mark Peterson and his group, published relatively recently, you can see there in 2016. They looked at the incidence of suspected adenocarcinoma in cats within the first year of treatment, medical treatment for hypothyroidism, and then followed them for a number of years, and you can see that the incidence of suspected adenocarcinoma was quite low in the first year of treatment, less than 1% of cats. But by the time cats had been on medical treatment for 4 years or more, the incidence of suspected adenocarcinoma had increased to nearly 1 in 5. Now, we know that the antithyroid drugs do have the potential to be carcinogenic, and that is obviously what has raised this concern. However, a limitation of this study is that it was there were no biopsies done. The suspicion of adenocarcinoma was based on the size of the thyroid gland and the response to medical treatment. So it may well be that there are cats here in this group who had very large thyroid glands because of the ongoing adenomatous change. We don't have definitive diagnosis of adenocarcinoma, so bear that in mind when interpreting that result. But nevertheless, it does raise a concern, and again, it has led some to suggest that for particularly relatively young hypothyroid cats, medical treatment in the long term may have some long-term consequences that we haven't yet been aware of. So that brings us round to another treatment option, dietary management. In this instance, this is the Hill's YD diet, and the idea here is that it has a restricted iodine content. It's not deficient in iodine. It provides adequate iodine for normal level of thyroid production, but it doesn't provide excess. And so even an adenomatous hypothyroid gland that in an ideal world would try to produce extra T4 doesn't have the building blocks and therefore cannot produce active hormone. So this is quite an elegant idea. It's a low iodine diet, but nutritionally otherwise it is a senior maintenance diet. So it does have moderately restricted protein and phosphate, and it can be an appropriate balanced diet for older cats and even cats with mild chronic kidney disease. But the tightly restricted iodine allows adequate thyroid synthesis, but not excessive production. So if we have a cat who will eat the diet and only eat that diet, because clearly it's important that the cat doesn't have any other sources of iodine in other dietary treats or other dietary supplements. If the cat will tolerate, will move over to the diet, and you should transition gradually and ensure that they are eating sufficient, because clearly a hypothyroid cat that doesn't like the diet and doesn't eat enough of it will lose weight very rapidly and could get into quite severe trouble. But if you can transition the cat over and persist for a reasonable period of time, the diet will generally control the T4 level within around 3 to 12 weeks. It takes longer the higher the thyroid level to start with. This is therefore rather slower control than you would expect with medical treatment, but nevertheless, over time, if the owner persists and only feeds YD diet, you should get good control in the majority of cases. A couple of recent studies looking at the use of this in the home environment, I think, are quite interesting, because the initial studies that were published were based on cats in research facilities, where obviously there was complete control of their diet, and they were obviously being handled and managed in a very ideal way. And in that ideal world, certainly the diet stands up very well, both in the short term and in the long term over many years of treatment. But of course, pet cats in a home environment is a slightly different situation, and that's the situation we are dealing with when we are managing our patients. So you can see in this study, 90% of the cats accepted the diet. Only a third accepted it immediately, but ultimately 90% did accept it. So if you're encouraging owners to look at this treatment option, we do need to support them through encouraging acceptance of the diet, even if the cat is not keen on first offering. And then the diets were fed for just over 2 months, so 64 days. And you can see that over that time, at the end of the period, 40% of the cats were assessed as having satisfactory clinical control. 40% had partial clinical control, but 20% had poor clinical control. Interestingly, there's no significant weight change across these groups of cats, and only around half of them had a free T4 that was within the reference range. And again, I guess that reflects the fact that only 40% had satisfactory clinical control. However, there was no increase in azotemia in response to treatment, which is obviously encouraging. And in this particular study, there was no further follow-up beyond the 2 months, which certainly would be a limitation of this study. A second study, fewer cats, only 49 cats in this study, but with a longer follow-up period, they found that total T4 normalized in 42% of the cats within 21 to 60 days, so similar to the previous study. But they followed these cats for longer, so they then followed them on, and by the 180-day time point, 83% of the cats had achieved normal T4. So it can be a slow response, but the majority of cats will get there in the end. And as I say, what they found was cats with a higher starting T4 took longer to respond, as we might expect. Again, though, clinical effect, there was no increase in body weight in these cats. Even though their thyroid level was controlled, they did not gain weight in the way that one might have expected. They had no reduction in heart rate. They actually had a significant decrease in creatinine over time. Now, we need to know more about this, but it may be that the reduced protein in this diet is not providing enough protein for these cats to regain body weight. So it may be enough to not have them lose body weight, but it may be that these cats actually need a slightly higher protein level than they're getting in order to regain lost body weight. But in this study, they then carried on treatment of dietary treatment for more than a year, and they found that the effect was well maintained. So if the diet does the job and produces a good effect, it does appear that it will continue to produce good effect for a long time. Again, saying that, it's not treating the primary disease. It doesn't usually control T4 into the lower half of the reference range, which traditionally has been the recommendation. Now, that means it can't cause hypothyroidism, but because it isn't an iodine-deficient diet, it does allow cats to produce, if you like, normal levels of T4, and therefore it doesn't necessarily bring them down into the lower half of the range. And whether that's a problem or not, we really don't yet know. And again, as with the as we talked about with medical treatment, it allows continued proliferation of thyroid tissue, continued adenomatous change. Might that lead to a risk of progression to carcinoma? We don't know. we saw that suspected increase in carcinoma in cats on medical treatment, which might be due to a direct carcinogenic effect of the drug, or might be because over time the adenomatous gland does tend to become carcinomatous. At the moment, we don't know which of those pertains, but if long-term uncontrolled adenomatous change may turn carcinomatous, then that could be a concern with YD diet as well. So there are things to consider, again, when we are thinking about really long-term use of these control methods. And so, again, I think really the current advice would be, if you pick up hypothyroidism in an otherwise healthy, relatively young cat that you hope has many years of life ahead of it, I think radioiodine is certainly the treatment recommendation of choice. Okay, so we've covered a fair amount of ground there in terms of the diagnostic applications of free T4 and TSH, where total T4 is normal. We've talked a bit about identifying hypothyroidism, and in particular azotemic hypothyroid cats, and using canine TSH as a useful tool to identify those cases, and the recommendation to treat those cats that are azotemic and hypothyroid, either by reducing their medical treatment if that's what we're using, or by supplementing thyroxine if they have had radioactive iodine. And then we've touched on the pros and cons of the various treatment options, whether that's radioiodine, medical management, or dietary management. So I hope it's been helpful. I'm very happy to take any questions just now if there are any. But otherwise, I hope it's been a useful webinar for you. The recording will be available to you, so if there are aspects that you want to refresh on, you will have the opportunity to go back and relook at the slides and the audio at your own leisure. Okay, so there is one question that has come in. It's quite an interesting one. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about it, because the question is about the transdermal methimazole. How effective is it, and how do we use it? So transdermal methimazole is something that's been used around the world for many, many years, but it's only relatively recently, in the last couple of years, that it's become available to us in the UK in a practical and affordable form, and that is really thanks to Summit, who have produced the little syringes of transdermal gel. So we have been using it for some time now, to good effect. It is, it is very effective. It takes a little longer to take effect than oral treatment, but equally it is less prone to the gastrointestinal adverse effects, and so that's a benefit. I would have to say, at the Oxford Cat Clinic, when it first became available, we had a lot of owners who were unable to dose their cats with tablets, who were keen to take on the transdermal methimazole and used it really to very good effect. So it's a good treatment. I would have to say the number of times we need to use it now that we have the liquid form of methimazole, so now we have ThyroNorm available, that does reduce the number of dosing issues that owners have with medical treatment. And so these days we would probably tend to use ThyroNorm in the first instance, and only resort to the transdermal methimazole when even that is proving difficult. But nevertheless, we do have a lot of good experience of using it as a good effective treatment, with similar range of adverse effects and concerns, and really dosing adjustments as exactly as you would with tablets. So I hope that helps and answers that question. Okay, well, with that, I'm going to hand back to Emma. Thank you all for your attention. I hope you enjoyed the webinar. I hope you found it useful, and I'm going to hand back to Emma at this point.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Martha for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.